United Nations sanctions. As diplomats wrangled over the wording, IAEA chief Yukiya Amano referred to his recent tough report on Iran, in which he says nuclear weapons activities may be continuing.
Now that I have this information and assessment, I must alert the world. This is my duty as the Director General.
The US and its close allies are reported to have settled for a less tough resolution than originally intended in the face of pressure from Russia and China. For NPR News, I'm Kerry Skyring in Vienna.
Dow is down 9 points at last check at 11,896. NASDAQ off about 21 points at 2619. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines.
Today's broadcast is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, located in Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the show, Harriet Williamson, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. We're sorry that we're not going to be able to do the show that we had scheduled. We weren't able to hook up with our guest, Julia Shears. We were going to talk about her book, A Thousand Lives, The Untold Story of Hope, Deception, and Survival at Jonestown. I'm sure that we can have this program rescheduled and have the conversation on another day. So instead, we will go to the Focus archives for a past broadcast. So as you listen to this hour, do keep in mind that for this hour, we'll not take calls. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about Afghanistan, and our guest is journalist Edward Girardet. He first went to Afghanistan in 1979. That was just 3 months before the Soviet invasion. And in the years since, he's traveled extensively in the country and spent time with key figures in its recent history. This morning in this hour, we'll have a conversation. He'll offer his thoughts on the current involvement of the U.S. in Afghanistan and perhaps suggest why it has failed to bring peace and stability to the country. He's the author of a recent book, which details some of his experience in the country over the years. The title of his book is Killing the Cranes, A Reporter's Journey Through 3 Decades of War in Afghanistan. Chelsea Green is the publisher, and it's out now. Edward Girardet has reported widely from humanitarian and conflict zones around the world, Africa, Asia, and elsewhere since the late 70s. He has been foreign correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, U.S. News and World Report, and the McNeil Lehrer News Hour. He's written for major publications also, including National Geographic Magazine, The Monitor, as I mentioned, the International Herald Tribune, Financial Times. He's also written and edited several books, and he is joining us this morning by telephone. And Mr. Girardet, hello.
Yes, hello, from Geneva.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, I should indeed say that he makes his home in Geneva, and he's speaking with us from there, and I much appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'd like to ask first maybe a two-part question, and then I'll try to ask it in two parts.
In June,
President Obama said that 5,000 troops were being withdrawn from Afghanistan immediately, another 5,000 would leave by the end of the year, and another 23,000 by the fall of 2012. That would still leave a significant number, like 68,000. The U.S. and the Afghan government are said to be working on an agreement that would keep some troops there in various capacities for a much longer time. So just the first part of the question is, this significant withdrawal of U.S. troops, if indeed this is accomplished in the next year or so, what will that mean for Afghanistan?
Well, I think one really has to go back a bit and ask the question, what was the point of becoming involved in Afghanistan militarily? I think historically it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. So I think when we're looking now at a staged withdrawal, which can work also both ways, on the one hand, the Taliban and other insurgent groups now read this as they can buy their time until 2014 as troops are gradually become removed, withdrawn from Afghanistan. And the question is, you know, has the military involvement of the U.S. and NATO forces there are about 45, 46 countries involved. Has it really made any difference being there militarily? Personally, I think the war, the military involvement has been completely pointless and makes no sense at all, despite, I have to add this, despite a lot of the good intentions of a lot of the troops, and also the fact that I think a lot of the officers I've met are extremely well-read, they've done their homework, but I think who have asked them to do an impossible task.
Yeah. I think it's really striking that at this point now, NATO forces have been in Afghanistan longer than the Soviets were. And it does indeed seem to be the case that there are a lot of people in Afghanistan who have come to regard the NATO forces as occupiers, and that it's not necessarily anti-Westernism. Perhaps they would feel that way about, or anti-Americanism, they'd feel that way about any outside power coming in. But the fact of the matter is they feel that way.
Absolutely. I mean, when the Soviets invaded, they came in with 115,000, 120,000 troops. And what this meant that they were occupying and fighting a war in Afghanistan with all these troops. But in fact, after 9 years of occupation, they achieved nothing at all except to destroy much of the country and also kill or cause the death of an estimated 1.5 million people in a 9-year occupation. I think they realized that the war was pointless from their point of view. They were achieving nothing. And they then left the country in February 1989, leaving the Afghan government forces to fend for themselves. And these forces actually managed to spend another 3 years staving off the Mujahideen or the Afghan guerrillas.
Hmm. Just to go back to some of the numbers there that I was tossing out at the very beginning, the second thing that I was interested in having you talk about is the fact that while the significant numbers of American troops will be leaving, there is this negotiation that's going on that would leave maybe, from what I have read, maybe as many as 25,000 troops in various kinds of capacities. And the number that has been tossed out, and it seems a little stunning, that it would leave those troops there until at least the year 2024. What would it mean that there would be this continuing involvement of the U.S., maybe not on the scale that we have now, but significant numbers of U.S. troops would still be there that far in the future?
Yeah. Well, the question, what they're trying to do basically is ensure that the Afghan government forces retain the ultimate responsibility for providing security in Afghanistan, and I think this doesn't look too good, because although there's been a lot of training of Afghan forces, including the police, you're dealing with an army which is heavily Tajik, which is more or less the northern people who supported the Northern Alliance, and then secondly, the Afghan police is about 90% illiterate, which means that they really can't understand what rule of law is all about. There have also been a lot of defections from the Afghan security forces. So I think to hope that the soldiers, you know, U.S. and NATO, will be able to sit back and, you know, remain in bases and providing logistical support to the Afghan military, I think that's sort of a bit of wishful thinking, because I don't think it's going to happen that way.
The government that we support, this government that is headed by Hamid Karzai, without outside support from the United States and elsewhere, could that government stand?
I don't think so. But again, you have to go back. I mean, Afghans have traditionally, even during the Soviet war, a lot of the Afghans remained in the government forces. Their families also had one foot with the Mujahideen, with the guerrillas. And this is a very basic Afghan survival technique, in that you have to look ahead to the future. You have to decide who's actually going to hang around and be there. And I think many Afghans don't think that U.S. or NATO forces will hang around and be there for them in the future. So I think the move will be more or less toward talking with everyone. I mean, that's what really has to happen. There has to be much more talking with the different groups involved. And there is no one Taliban. I mean, we keep talking about the need to talk to the Taliban, but in fact, what we're looking at is an armed opposition, which includes the Taliban and includes other insurgent groups or networks such as the Haqqani Network, or which is based actually in Pakistan, or Hezbi Islami, which is a group that we heavily supported during the 1980s. This is a very extremist group headed by a rather ruthless character known as Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who is now fighting us after we had supported him during the Soviet war. So a lot of the people who are fighting are actually former Mujahideen, or the fathers of and sons of former Mujahideen. And so the Afghan army itself, I doubt that it can really hold out on its own. It will need the money. That you have to pay salaries. If you don't pay salaries, and we saw this, you know, when the Soviets left, the money ran out, and the Afghan army actually fought quite well. I mean, their backs were against the wall. Many thought they would be executed because they were supporting a communist regime which was godless. But when the money ran out, a lot of the militia groups pulled back, they joined the other side, and then everything began to collapse very, very quickly. So it all came down to money in the end.
Well, this, I suppose, maybe in some people's minds raises this basic question about if we're talking about, we have this vision of a kind of a stable and peaceful and functional Afghanistan. If we have this idea that somehow that conforms to the models that we know, where we have people around the country who have some sort of idea that they are citizens of Afghanistan, that they're Afghan people, and that they have some important connection or allegiance to a central government that's in Kabul, is such a thing actually, given the history of Afghanistan, is such a thing actually possible?
Well, ironically, during the Soviet war, that was the time when Afghans actually came together as a nation. They have this expression, Watandar, which means countrymen. And this used to mean, in the 1970s, perhaps early 80s, it meant, you know, someone from your village or from your district. But as the war developed against the Soviets, when Mujahideen met each other on trails, and I traveled a lot with the Mujahideen in the mountains, they would wave to each other, and instead of saying, hey, you, they would say, Watandar, meaning, you know, countrymen. And I found it was sort of very quaintly 19th century, and that meant that they were calling someone else from a different part of the country. They would shake hands, and then each would go in his own direction, but they actually saw themselves united in this fight against the Soviets. When the Soviets collapsed, basically, and withdrew, the whole notion of Watandar, of countrymen, this nationhood, began to disintegrate. So what you're looking at today is really a highly complex nation, and I'm being generous here, consisting of different tribal, different ethnic, different religious groups, and somehow we're trying to impose a system from the outside which satisfies us in the West, because we want to have a central government, we want everything to be organized. But in fact, I think the future of Afghanistan, its best way of holding together, is by giving much more responsibility to the rural areas, to the different regions and provinces, because these are the people. The local people want to be with the people they trust. And in a sense, they're going back to age-old traditions, which were basically pretty badly ravaged over the past 30 years of war.
Our guest in this hour is Edward Girardet. He's a journalist, writer, producer. He's reported from many places around the world and has spent quite a lot of time in Afghanistan, going back to the first time that he went there, which was actually before the Soviet invasion. He's authored a number of books. His most recent is an account of his experiences in Afghanistan. The title of his book is Killing the Cranes, A Reporter's Journey Through 3 Decades of War in Afghanistan. Chelsea Green is the publisher. Questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm sure that some people, if you engage them in a conversation about Afghanistan and talk about, well, why is the country the way it is, some people will say, well, you go back to the U.S. invasion in 2001. Or some people would say, well, no, what you really have to do is you have to go back further. You have to go back to the Soviet invasion of 1979 and the battle that was fought to drive out the Soviets. But I wonder if we could go back just a little bit further, because apparently both the Soviets and the United States had been involved in Afghanistan, actually going back to the 1950s.
Yes, absolutely. They were both countries were providing development aid, and each country was trying to out-aid the other. The Americans built the roads, which were east to west. The Soviets built the roads, which were north to south. And ironically, with the invasion, the north to south roads were the ones which proved the better investment. They also, I mean, the Americans invested very heavily in the Helmand River project, which was a huge irrigation project, which began in the 1950s. In fact, even before that. And which today, by the way, is where a lot of U.S. troops have been involved, and British troops as well, in the Helmand River area. And also it's an area where most of the poppy growing, or a lot of the poppy growing, is now taking place for opium. The Soviets, they also took a lot of young Afghans, sent them to the Soviet Union, or to Czechoslovakia, to Bulgaria, to the East Bloc countries for education. They also took thousands of children and tried to Sovietize them, or to come back as a sort of the new Afghan man or the new Afghan socialist man. And in fact, a lot of that actually backfired. It didn't work out the way they had hoped, because many came back and were actually quite anti-Soviet when they returned. The Americans, you know, had a lot of aid workers who I think did actually some very interesting work. And when you meet these people today who had actually worked there during the 1970s, these are the people, you know, Americans, agriculturalists, engineers, who are actually some of the most dedicated people I've met. And I think the involvement was actually quite an interesting one, because a lot of the lessons we had learned in the 50s and 60s from Afghanistan or 70s need to be, in a sense, reapplied today. So you had this battle, and then eventually the Soviets won over by their people got into power, and then that's how the war began in the summer of 1978, just after the communists came to power.
Well, it's still, I would think that now people in Russia, looking back on this, if they were being honest, they would say this was a pretty serious mistake, the invasion. And it's never been entirely clear to me why it was the Soviets felt that that was necessary.
Well, there were a whole series of reasons. One was, don't forget, at the time, Ayatollah Khomeini had just come to power in neighboring Iran, and there was a movement of Afghans. The rebellion was beginning to grow against the communist regime, which was quite repressive, and the rebels, who were very conservative Islamic, you know, tribesmen, were killing off government officials and, you know, teachers. And there was a very real threat of the guerrillas taking over power very, very quickly. And the last thing the Soviets wanted was to have another Islamic regime on their doorstep. Another reason was the old traditional czarist dream of having a warm water port on the Indian Ocean. So Afghanistan was one of the last final steps toward the Indian Ocean. Another was the fact that you could run, you know, gas pipelines through. There are some natural resources. It was also a way of getting closer to Pakistan and India. So there were a whole variety of reasons, also some which were just purely opportunistic.
Mm. And as far as the United States is concerned, when we intervened and on the side, or at least provided support to the fighters that were trying to drive out the Soviets, this was on one level, I suppose one could see this as a proxy war between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, one of those little side conflicts against the bigger conflict of the Cold War. Was there, though, were there concrete, though, interests that the United States had in having a government there that it had some influence on?
Well, the main reason I think that the U.S. got involved was because they wanted to give the Soviets their own Vietnam, and what a great way of doing it by supporting the Afghan guerrillas in Afghanistan. That was fine in a sense, but what they began to do was that the CIA relied extremely heavily on the ISI, which was the Pakistani Military Intelligence Organization, which had very much its own agenda and still does. Nothing has changed really there. So what they did was they relied massively on the Pakistani intelligence for who to support, who not to support. And in the end, the bulk of Western or mainly American assistance, which went to the Mujahideen, the guerrillas, went to fundamentalist extremists such as Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who we helped build up by giving him weapons, including Stingers, a lot of money. I mean, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. And they were also supported, these extremists were supported by the Saudis. Also, we, you know, were involved with Bin Laden at the time because he had all these Islamic legionaries coming in. And this is all part of the Pakistani agenda. Their main interest, of course, always has been, and is still today, India, but they didn't want to have the Soviets on their Western front, you know, having any influence over Pakistan. So we basically relied on the Pakistanis and got, I think, a lot deeper into supporting the wrong people. And there were a lot of good commanders, you know, nationalists, people who were actually quite close to the Afghan people who fought inside Afghanistan. And a lot of these people were ignored, like Ahmad Shah Massoud from the north and Abdul Haq, who was a very effective Pashtun commander, in favor of these increasingly corrupt politicians who were based in Peshawar, Pakistan, and then all these extremists who are now, many of them, you know, are fighting us in Afghanistan.
Yeah, that's just another one of these things that's it's very difficult to understand. And one, I think I'm sure you have to be careful about reducing this down, but I think that you spent a lot of time talking about two men in particular, both men that you knew, or at least that you had met, as two kind of polar opposites. One, and you've mentioned both, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was assassinated just right before 9/11. He was the man who was the leader of the Northern Alliance. It seemed that that things could well have gone differently if we had decided more clearly to support one than the other. But then you come back to this question was, well, why is it that we bet on Hekmatyar and not really on Ahmad Shah Massoud?
Well, I knew both of them very well, and Massoud was a very impressive character, but he was a commander who operated primarily inside Afghanistan. He had to rely to an extent on the Peshawar politicians for his support to get weapons and money, but he set up his own resistance front inside Afghanistan, which became extremely effective and staved off major Soviet-Afghan operations with, you know, up to 12,000 troops. And I witnessed one of these with, you know, massive air support, ground support, and yet he managed to stave them off. Massoud also eventually got to Kabul after the communist regime collapsed. A huge, rather ruthless battle developed between Hekmatyar and Massoud for the battle over Kabul. And eventually Hekmatyar, who was actually heavily supported by the Pakistanis, he had to give up and disappeared, actually went to Iran, and Massoud continued, but then the Taliban came into the game, into the equation, and by 2001, Massoud was the last significant commander to actually be opposing the Taliban. But, you know, again, Gulbuddin was someone we supported. He murdered hundreds of Afghan intellectuals, of commanders who opposed him or were critical of him. And despite all the information that was made available to Washington, this included journalists, aid workers, some extremely astute State Department people who kept warning Washington not to support these extremists because they would come back and bite us in the future, these warnings were completely ignored. And, you know, some members of the CIA who I met at various meetings, you know, these think tanks around D.C., around the Beltway, they kept saying, no, Gulbuddin is the most effective commander on the ground. And I kept saying, as did other journalists, I'm sorry, but, you know, go inside Afghanistan, you'll see a totally different picture.
Yeah. Our guest is Edward Girardet. He's a journalist. He's reported from many places around the world and has spent a lot of time in Afghanistan, has written for many major publications, National Geographic magazine, Christian Science Monitor, International Herald Tribune, and has authored several books, including his most recent, Killing the Cranes, A Reporter's Journey Through Three Decades of War in Afghanistan. We have a couple of callers here we'll bring into the conversation, starting with somebody in Champaign County here where we are. It's line one. Hello.
Hi. Good morning.
Hi.
I can imagine you gazing out over Loch Lomond, getting a good perspective on the world.
It's beautiful weather.
The thing I wanted to get to, well, in this last bit of discourse, you were encapsulating the scenario of how things happened, and the proxy war was mentioned, but between Zbigniew Brzezinski's admission that they weren't worried about a few stirred-up Muslims, which it goes to your last point. There was also an admission that the U.S. was already engaged in the proxy war before the Soviets came in. In fact, it was sort of an entrapment concept. I don't know if you buy that, but that's one thing that I think has to come up. When you talk about what's at stake in Afghanistan, it's useless to be there. I agree, but if it was just Afghanistan, now you know all the theorists here talk about the AFPAC, the region at Pakistan, and the reason we have to stay in Afghanistan is because of Pakistan. Now, I've read a few books, probably need to read yours, and there's another one called Crossing Zero that you may have heard about that I'm curious about. But the whole region is a colonial remnant, basically. Tariq Ali suggests, and I haven't really found the documentation, that the Fatah regions were sort of on the same lines of Hong Kong, where they were supposed to revert back to Afghanistan. And what we have is this Pashtunistan that's divided by the zero border, the Durand Line. And until somebody does something to resolve that, it seems. I mean, the Pakistanis, in a way, nod to that because the Fatah, the tribal areas, they still use remnants of British colonial rule to when they like to do their reprisals, et cetera, and collective punishment. It's such a complicated circumstance, but you know, we're not there to set up some kind of Valhalla in Afghanistan. We're there for, you mentioned that Afghanistan has always been the crossroads of trade and with pipelines. Another thing I've learned about is some neocons here have this new map of Pakistan that includes the independent Baluchistan with the idea of, you know, cutting off Iran from China and gas lines and et cetera, et cetera. And basically the oil and gas politics of the region need to be seen. And there's been frank admissions of this by the former NATO chief that they were not there to reprisals for 9/11. We're there for, well, I'm going on, and I've given you enough fodder to respond to. Maybe you want to start with the first point about whether you believe that there was this entrapment theory.
All right. Well, yes.
The U.S. did become involved with the Mujahideen, primarily with money. And I don't think too much, but they were involved, I think it was from July 1979 at least onwards, if not earlier. I'm not sure it could be regarded as entrapment because, you know, at the time, I mean, I also covered Angola, Mozambique, you know, Zimbabwe, Horn of Africa. At the time, there were a lot of proxy wars going on, and some were won or lost, in inverted commas. But the thing is, you're absolutely right, the colonial aspect. I mean, a lot of Afghans, of course, officially Afghanistan has not recognized the Durand Line. This is the unilateral demarcation line that was imposed in 1893 by Sir Mortimer Durand, which divided British India with Afghanistan, still giving the Brits the right to manipulate foreign policy in Afghanistan. But many Afghans, they have these sort of calendars or agendas, their diaries, and they actually have maps of Afghanistan which extend as far as the Indus, which, of course, infuriates the Pakistanis because they consider Peshawar firmly in their grasp. But many Afghans consider Peshawar the traditional summer or rather winter location for the kings of Afghanistan. So there is definitely that whole colonial aspect, and the Pakistanis did lock, stock, and barrel adopt the British approach toward the tribal areas, the Fatah areas, as you mentioned. And, you know, for a long time, the federal government, the British before them, could only guarantee your safety within 1 yard of the road. If you walked further, that was that was your problem. I, of course, walked through a lot of these tribal areas during the 1980s because the Afghan guerrillas had negotiated with the Pakistani-Afghan tribes, and many of whom live on both sides of the border. So there were all these family and links between each other, and you could walk quite safely through these areas. There's no way I would do that today because those links no longer exist. And in fact, even people I know in Jalalabad, which is in eastern Afghanistan, who I know to be sympathetic to the Taliban and may even be themselves Taliban,
they will not, they've refused to take me into certain areas because they, and sort of apologetically saying, we can't take you there because we can't guarantee your safety because we don't know those people in that area. There have been a lot of new, you know, foreign Taliban, what they call foreign Taliban, have come in from Pakistan, and these foreign Taliban don't have the same connection with local communities as do the Afghan Taliban on the Afghan side.
In this hour of focus, we're talking with Edward Jaradet. He's a journalist. He's reported widely from many places around the world, Africa, Asia, elsewhere. His work has appeared in many places, National Geographic Magazine, Christian Science Monitor, International Herald Tribune, Financial Times. He's also written and edited several books. His most recent is titled Killing the Cranes, A Reporter's Journey Through 3 Decades of War in Afghanistan, published by Chelsea Green. And we have a caller here who's been patient with us. We'll get to them in Champaign, and this is line number 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Hi.
I wonder if you could address what I think of as a sort of an institutional question. You made a remark earlier about how a lot of our military commanders there were rather well-read and tried to familiarize themselves with the complexities of Afghanistan. I'm just wondering, to the extent, I'm always sort of appalled that we spend so much money on intelligence and then get so many things wrong, like, as you alluded to, backing the wrong people in Afghanistan, sort of less than more than a minor point. But I'm wondering, with respect to the intelligence or competence or aims of the CIA and State Department, are they in a dichotomy, or is there some way that they're working towards the same end, or do you see, like, confusion being the best estimate of what's happening there with our forces and our policy? And I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you. No, I do see a dichotomy. I mean, a lot of the State Department people I've met, they're aware, I think, of the shortcomings, and I think over the past 30 years there have been some exceptional individuals who have tried to keep Washington informed, also keep the CIA informed about what was going right or wrong. And you know, the mistakes, as you point out, have been, you know, one after the other, and some of them extremely basic. I mean, the first big mistake, I think, was that the CIA relied so heavily on the Pakistanis, on ISI, the military intelligence organization, for their basic information, when quite clearly, I mean, anyone could have told them and did tell them that Pakistan had very much its own agenda. And I think also what happened prior to the events of 9/11, and I think this really needs to be looked at very closely, is that in early 2001, you had Commander Ahmad Shah Massoud went to Paris, his first trip ever to Europe. And while in Paris, he met with U.S. officials, and he warned them about several things. One was that al-Qaeda, who, by the way, we had supported as well logistically in the 1980s under bin Laden. I mean, al-Qaeda was not known as an organization at that time. But Massoud warned that al-Qaeda was preparing a major operation against the West, probably in the United States. Secondly, he reasserted that it would just not be appropriate to have any form of foreign intervention in Afghanistan because that would just re-stimulate a new war. And thirdly, perhaps the most important, was that the Pakistanis had to be pressured to stop supporting the Taliban, as well as the Saudis, because at the time, and this is again back in, you know, early, mid-2001, the Taliban were heavily, massively supported by the Pakistanis and by the Saudis. And I'm not just talking about al-Qaeda, but I'm talking about the Saudi government as well, or elements within the Saudi government. The Pakistanis provided air support with their own Air Force officers. There were thousands of what they called were retired military supporting the Taliban inside Afghanistan. So the argument was that if the support were stopped for the Pakistanis, then the Taliban would probably collapse very quickly. And in fact, at the time, the Taliban were already in the process of imploding, and there were several key commanders, such as Massoud and another Abdul Haq, who is probably one of the most effective Pashtun tribal commanders in eastern Afghanistan. They were already negotiating and collaborating in the setting up of a new anti-Taliban alliance involving a lot of tribal groups, including Taliban, who are ready to cross over. They reckon they could probably attract over half the Taliban because the Taliban were getting fed up with the Pakistanis telling them what to do. They were getting fed up with the arrogance of the likes of Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda was not the only Arab group on the ground. There were others. So there was a lot of disenchantment which needed to be taken advantage of. And when you had the events of 9/11, there was so much emotion and anger in the United States that there was a lack of willingness to really look at what were the real possibilities on the ground of what to do. And, you know, a number of people, I mean, Massoud was killed. He was assassinated September 9th. Abdul Haq was still trying to get attention and support from the British and the Americans for this plan, this new plan to sort of save Afghanistan without having a new war, but actually making better use of the collapse, the potential collapse of the Taliban. And we totally ignored him. He went in on his own with limited support and was either betrayed or he was captured by the Taliban and killed. So there were basically two individuals who, you know, with their strengths and weaknesses, who should have been taken better advantage of and should have been listened to. And in the end, I think the bombing of October 7th created a new war which was totally unnecessary. So because we made so many mistakes, and then after the bombing, when the West got involved with Afghanistan, we no longer focused on the recovery of Afghanistan. We became involved in this war on terrorism. And the Taliban were not terrorists. They were a faction within a rather ruthless and brutal war. The Al-Qaeda could be perhaps regarded as a terror organization, but the Taliban were one of the factions involved. And the moment you get involved in a civil war, you're asking for trouble. And I think this has been shown in numerous civil wars around the different continents. Hmm.
Ahmad Shah Massoud was assassinated by Al-Qaeda. And this took
That's
place,
right.
as you mentioned, just a couple of days before 9/11. Now, you could understand why they would target Massoud, as he was an effective agent against the Taliban with which they were, or some of the Taliban with which they were allied. So that it would make sense. Other than that, though, was there some connection between Massoud's assassination and 9/11, or is it just that they just happened to occur together in time, and the effective agents were the same in both cases?
I think there was something closely connected, in the sense that this was a present of Al-Qaeda to the Taliban. They wanted to get rid of Massoud as quickly as possible. Also, the realization that if there was a backlash after what happened in, you know, September 11th, that at least they would get rid of Massoud, and they would be enable to continue operating inside Afghanistan. So I think that was quite crucial. And the second point was that by getting rid of Massoud, they thought they could perhaps enable the Taliban to take the rest of the country. But I think even that plan might have backfired in the long run.
Was there any point when the Taliban, the leadership of the Taliban, and I'm thinking of those that were led by Mullah Omar that were affiliated with Al-Qaeda, was there any point at which they regretted ever having had anything to do with Osama bin Laden?
I think the top people of the Taliban, and you know, we may be talking about 20 or 30 people, were, I'm not saying they were well-educated, because, in fact, one of the major characteristics of the Taliban was that most of them were illiterate and not, you know, not educated at all. I think that the top group, the elites, they were the ones who were aware of what Al-Qaeda was doing. They were aware there was a global agenda, and they could have done something about it. But probably even at that stage, it would have been difficult even for Mullah Omar, despite U.S. pressure, to actually kick the Arabs out. I think they've become too entrenched. I think for the rank and file of the Taliban, they hadn't a clue of what the whole agenda was. They knew that they didn't particularly like the Pakistanis. They didn't particularly like the Arabs, because the Arabs have always been very arrogant toward the Afghans. So I think, you know, to even regard the rank and file as being knowledgeable about any global agenda, I think that's really pushing it. But I think certainly the top elite.
Mm. When one goes back to the point where the Soviets were driven out, and then what happened is that the Afghans who were fighting the Soviets turned to fighting each other, and that led to 4 years of civil war. One is tempted to ask at that point when the Soviets left, how could things have gone differently? It seems that the big problem there, though, is that there were a number of independent rival armed groups here that were receiving support from a number of governments, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Iran. The Soviets had been in there. We had been in there. And that there was really nothing holding them together. They felt they owed nothing to the central government. But I think you can't underestimate the importance here of the involvement of outsiders in setting up the civil war that followed the defeat of the Soviets.
Yeah, I mean, everyone who's been involved with Afghanistan from the outside has had their own agenda, and I don't think the Americans had the Afghans at heart, neither did the Chinese, neither did Al-Qaeda, neither did the Pakistanis. I mean, you can go right down the list. They were all in Afghanistan for their own reasons. And I think this is something that ordinary Afghans feel very, very strongly and will often tell you, that they just feel they've been used and abused nonstop by outsiders. And I think it's true. The battle for Kabul was probably unnecessary as well, but the Pakistanis, ISI, were really pushing Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. They wanted him to move as quickly as possible on Kabul and take Kabul. But what was happening at the time was that also quite a few of the commanders were very much aware of, these are the commanders on the inside, who were not directly affiliated other than through weapons and other support with the political parties, the Afghan resistance parties in Pakistan. They realized that they had to be talks, and they were actually talking with members of the Afghan government about having a sort of a peaceful resolution, because, you know, the way Afghan things are, every Afghan has one foot with one camp, one foot with another camp, and their third foot and fourth feet elsewhere in other camps, because they're always looking at long-term survival, and they have to make arrangements. And Afghans have always been able to talk in one way or another, even if they fought each other rather brutally. And this is what has always struck me, is then I'd come into villages and they'd say, oh, there's Ahmed over there, he's a Hezbi, or there's so-and-so over there, and he belongs to another group. And yet they were all talking together on the inside. But on the outside, there was too much money. There was too much military support. The Afghan politicians in Peshawar were totally corrupt, and they're the ones actually now back in power. You know, we've enabled the warlords and all these former politicians and their cohorts to come back into power. So, you know, ordinary Afghans are really disillusioned, and the whole thing then just went down in this very fast spiral to, you know, to hell, basically. And when the Taliban came up, many ordinary Afghans supported the Taliban because the Taliban offered peace and security. I mean, they were pretty ruthless when it came to anyone stealing or killing or attacking. And they basically made the roads inside Afghanistan completely safe. And I'm saying this went on for a while. Then the Taliban began getting repressive, you know, toward the other minority groups, such as the Hazaras, who are the Central Highland Shias. They're Mongolian-featured people who've always been regarded as the underdogs of Afghan society, but actually emerged during the Soviet war as very, very good fighters. The Taliban were trying to eradicate them, in a sense. Also, the fight with the Tajiks in the north, the people of Massoud, or the Uzbeks in the north. So then it became a sort of fratricidal war.
Well, and now it seems that again, we were talking about the future of Afghanistan. We still have a serious problem with outside parties that have their interests in the country, or at least in the sense that they're interested in having a regime where they can have some significant influence. And so we're still talking about Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Iran. How does Absolutely. One talk about some kind of stable future for the country without somehow getting them involved?
Well, they have to be involved in one way or another, and there has to be pressure on them. And in a sense, one has to almost name and shame them. And this means everyone involved, whether the Americans, the Europeans, the Iranians, the Pakistanis, the Chinese. But in the end, it's really going to be up to the Afghans themselves to work things out. And I think they can do that, because there are institutions that will enable them to talk with each other, although a lot of these traditional institutions have been badly mauled by the war, by 30 years of fighting. But they can be resuscitated, I think. And I think a lot of the aid workers who've been working in Afghanistan for years on end, they are dealing with all the communities. They talk with, they talk with the Taliban, they talk with NATO, they talk with local communities, local tribesmen, the village elders, and that's the only way it's going to work. That's the only way you can do it. But this is a very, very long process. It could be 20, 30 years. The other aspect is, as you mentioned, are the outsiders. Somehow there has to be maybe an international conference where they pledge, and, you know, whether this is possible, you know, we have to be realistic, will these outsiders actually stand back and say, okay, we'll support recovery and we'll stop meddling? But, you know, the history has always shown with Afghanistan that everyone wants to meddle in Afghanistan. And that, for me, is actually the biggest problem. It's a much bigger problem than the Taliban or the insurgents.
Mm. We have just a couple of minutes left. We have some other callers. We'll try to get at least one. They'll help us by being brief. We'll go to Effingham, line 4. Hello.
Yes, I'll keep it short. Your guest is talking about those events around in those countries, and that's an old system. Now, my question is, could a KGB, when they were in Afghanistan, and now we're there, with the CIA and the KGB looked upon as a terrorist and terrorist organizations, and the disruption that they bring early before uniforms and tanks show up? Thank you.
It's a good question, but I think most Afghans probably wouldn't differentiate between, CIA and soldiers, because tragically nowadays even there's a confusion between aid workers and soldiers. They're sort of thrown into the same cauldron. But I think a lot of Afghans realize that there's a lot of meddling going on behind the scenes, and, they will sometimes say CIA or, you know, KGB. I mean, even Massoud, when I first met him, he said, I don't know whether you're a journalist or you're a CIA, but we want to talk with the Americans. And I tried to explain to him that it was not my job to engineer support, but I could, you know, help them get in touch, and then it was up to them. It was out of my hands. So that's going on. Also today, you know, a lot of former KGB are now actively involved with drug trafficking, because they made all their contacts in the 1980s. And now, you know, with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the whole narcotics trade, I mean, Afghanistan represents over 90% of world opium production. Very little actually goes to Afghans. About $3 billion worth goes to Afghanistan. The $194 billion that was made last year out of opium and poppy obviously goes to countries like Russia, the United States, Europe, and so on, so from Nigeria.
We're coming down to the point here. We have just about 2 minutes, a little bit less. Just a personal question. I'm just curious. You know, today, if one was a correspondent that specialized in conflict and you wanted to go someplace where there was a big story, a very big story, well, Afghanistan might be a place that you would choose. You went there even before the Soviet invasion. What was it? Was there something in particular that interested you about Afghanistan, or some reason that you thought that was an important place to go?
Well, I was a young American foreign correspondent in Paris, and I wanted to become Hemingway, but I couldn't become Hemingway. But I kept meeting all these journalists who had covered Vietnam or were then covering Salvador, Central America, photographers. And, you know, I just kept hearing all these stories, and I realized I had to go and find my own war, in a sense. And a good friend of mine who had covered Vietnam as a reporter from Time magazine, he said, look, you know, there's this little war starting in Afghanistan. And that was actually the main reason why I went out. I'd been there once before as a student, just after school. I was hitchhiking my way to India, and I passed through Afghanistan. And I'd always remembered it as being, an exceptional place, and I really wanted to go back. But I think I was much more fascinated by the fact that there was this little war growing. And, you know, as things happen, you know, you become, after 2 weeks, become a so-called expert, not really, but, you know, people think you are. And then I just found myself covering it. And I think overall, however, it's Afghanistan becomes a passion. I mean, it's an extraordinary country, extraordinary people, infuriating people sometimes, but, you know, you just get very, very attached. And you'll find that many foreigners, Americans, Europeans, and others who have worked in Afghanistan, they all feel the same thing. There's something which just draws you. I mean, the landscape is extraordinary, with the Hindu Kush mountains, with the deserts. And I found myself sort of missing it. So I've always made sure that I'd go back. At the same time, though, you know, I'm not sure I would recommend it, because it has become much, much more dangerous to cover these days. And, you know, during the Soviet war, it was less dangerous.
Yeah. Well, there we'll have to leave it. Our guest, Edward Jaraday, first began covering Afghanistan several months before the Soviet invasion in 1979, and has spent a lot of time there since, has written about it, and has written for many publications: National Geographic, Christian Science Monitor, International Herald Tribune. He's also written and edited several books. His most recent, if you'd like to read it, an account of some of his experiences in Afghanistan. The title of his book is Killing the Cranes: A Reporter's Journey Through Three Decades of War in Afghanistan. Chelsea Green is the publisher. Mr. Jaraday, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. This was a show we first broadcast in August. And we sometimes do that as a fallback position when things don't pan out as we expect. And that was the case this morning with the program that we had scheduled. We were going to talk with journalist Julia Shears about her book, A Thousand Lives, The Untold Story of Hope, Deception, and Survival at Jonestown. We will have that show rescheduled for another day. In the meantime, you can check up on the schedule and listen to past programs by going to our website. And that is WILL.illinois.edu. And I can tell you that tomorrow, in the first part of the show, we'll be doing our regular monthly program on personal finance. David Sinnoh will be our guest. He's a clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I and is on the program once a month. It's always a Friday. He begins by talking a little bit about the economy, or maybe there's a particular topic that he'd like to discuss, and then we open it up to questions. And anything that you might want to ask that has to do with your own personal financial planning, call in and you can talk with Dave. Then in the second hour, we'll have another visit with Jim Rybacki. He's a pharmacist. He's editor of the newsletter, The Essential Guide to Medical News. He's president of the Medicine Information Institute. He knows a lot about prescription medicines. And when he is on the program, this is an opportunity for people to call in and ask questions about medicines that you're taking. And he's very good at answering those sorts of questions. And he is also very much involved with heart disease and trying to prevent it. And our major focus for our conversation tomorrow will be just that. He's just recently attended a meeting of the American Heart Association. And so we'll talk about what is new in treating heart disease. But of course, any other questions that have to do with prescription medicines, those things will be welcome. So that's tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon with 10 different topics. And once again, you check the schedule by looking at the website. It is WILL.illinois.edu.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's music heritage at the University of Illinois. Now featuring new exhibits entitled A Century of Stories and Sounds from the Stage, Music, Dance, and Theater in America. More information is at SousaArchives.org.
Director Alexander Payne's films find comedy in the crisis of his flawed protagonists, a struggling writer and wine snob in Sideways, a retired widower on a road trip in About Schmidt, and now a family man who must face a difficult truth in Payne's new film, The Descendants. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Alexander Payne. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support comes from Subaru of Champaign County, located on Route 45 in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieved zero landfill status, with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
That's it for us on Focus. We want you to stay tuned. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine, the host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana. Online at will.illinois.edu. Let's take a look at commodity prices now. In Kansas City, December wheat trading at 668 and three quarters, down 18 and a quarter. March, 680 and a half, down 19 and a quarter. December wheat, Chicago, 594, down 22 and three quarters. March, 612 and three quarters, down 25. December corn, 614 1/4, down 28.5. March, 622 1/2, down 29.5. May, 629, down 29. July, 633, down 27.5. January soybeans, 1164, that's off 23.75. March, 1174, down 24. May, 1184 1/4, down 23.5. July, 1193, down 24. December soybean meal, 291 even, that's down 540. The December soybean oil contract off 111 at 51.37. December live cattle, 120.95, down 110. February, 123.52 1/2, down 77.5. November feeder cattle, 143.17 1/2, down